Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is podcast 17 for Tuesday, September 22nd. I'll be your host this week. My name is David O'Brien, and with me today I've got
Dominic Rabier
and Ben Snitkoff.
This week we have two big stories that came out. The first is Veo and UMG, which have been embroiled in litigation for some time now involving some DMCA disputes, and also another decision involving the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, called LVRC v. Breca. We also have two other possible stories that we might cover, but these first two are big enough that we think it might take up most of the show. But, of course, if we have time, we'll see what we can do with these other two. And if we don't get to them, we will post them on our blog. So, diving right into it. Ben, what can you tell me about the Veo case that came down this week?
So, this is a case that involves, shockingly, one of the few major law topics that I don't think we've discussed yet on the podcast. It's the safe harbor provisions under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. So, Veo is a video sharing website, kind of like YouTube, but different from YouTube. And they have a lot of videos on their website that are uploaded by their users. And UMG will frequently send Veo takedown notices to say, you know, whatever this content is, you know, this particular video on your website, it's infringing our copyrights, you need to take it down. So, Veo had been doing that over time. They even enacted certain things. They put a hash program on their servers so that if a video was taken down and a person re-uploaded it, that would automatically be taken down too. They eventually even got this blocking software that would analyze videos as they came up, as they were uploaded, and just didn't allow anything to be posted that contained copyright information. But nonetheless, they were sued for copyright infringement, much like YouTube has been sued for copyright infringement by several people. Although, interestingly enough, the YouTube cases have kind of been stalled for the last couple of years. But this case has gone forward and actually given us a couple of rulings so far. So this latest one is whether or not Veo gets protection under the safe harbor provisions of the DMCA.
So I think it's pretty sensible to start off with the DMCA safe harbor, especially since we have not covered it, like you mentioned before, on the show. What is the safe harbor? Where can we find it? And you know, how might it apply to this case and other cases that are sort of similarly situated?
Okay, so I'm gonna recruit you guys for help here because it's kind of an extensive thing. But sure, you can find the safe harbor at 17 USC section 512 subsection C of the Copyright Act, and subsequent sections and all around there. Essentially what it says, and this is extremely brief, if you don't have actual knowledge that the material is infringing and you take it down as soon as somebody tells you that it's infringing, then you're not going to be held liable for content that other people post on your website that infringes copyrights.
So the big thing, just to cut you off real quick, and Dominic will get right to you, the big thing is that this applies to user-generated content mostly. I mean, it could apply to other things, but that's one of the more the prominent examples of how the safe harbor has been used.
So to sort of build on that, note, I guess the word actual knowledge sort of stands out to me. That's a legal term of art. Say I set up a little website called technicallylegaltube.com or something where you can upload cool videos about law and technology, and someone uploads the latest music video for some popular artist there, and I don't do anything, I don't look at what's uploaded, it all is automated, it all goes up automatically. Could I use the safe harbor provision if a company attacks me? Like, say that the owner of that music video says, hey, you're posting my music video without consent, it's copyrighted, I want you to take it down, I'm going to sue you. I take it down, can I use the safe harbor provision? Or did I have actual knowledge? Like, what is actual knowledge in this situation?
Well, that was obviously one of the key contentions in the suit here. When do you get actual knowledge? And the Section 512 sets up basically a scheme for a way that content holders, the copyright holders themselves, or the people that own the copyrights, can send a notice to, say, like a service provider, like a website, and say, hey, somebody is infringing my content on the website. I am the true owner of this content. I want you to take it down. And under the Act, the key portion of the Act is that once that notice is sent, you're basically giving some sort of knowledge, or you're almost imputing knowledge onto the service provider, the website itself. And at that point, the Act requires the website to expeditiously take down the infringing material.
Right, and courts have held that those takedown notices have to include some sort of assertion that you actually own the copyrighted material. Actually, I think that's a requirement of the Act. You also need to, you know, send a link to it so they know what to remove. But there's actually some contrary law in that there is a case, ALS Scan, in which the owner of copyrights in adult images sent a takedown notice, kind of non-complying takedown notice, to a Usenet hoster that said, listen, you've got this forum on your Usenet that's entitled ALS Scan Photos. All of the photos on there have our trademark and a little copyright notification in the logo, you know, embedded in the image. Take those down. And the court held that that was sufficient notice, which is contrary to, I mean, kind of to what we see in this case, but definitely to what we typically think of as the takedown notice, which is very specific and calling out, you know, one or multiple infringing sites by a URL.
So the Section 512 is, I guess you could say, has been the bane of the existence to some of these content ownership companies, you know, the record companies in particular, and also, you know, TV networks or TV production studios and other people like that, because it shields the deep-pocketed service providers. I guess deep-pocketed meaning that these companies potentially have a lot of money. It shields them from certain parts of copyright infringement liability. And I think the sort of the core portion of this case was really about when should 512 apply? When should a service provider be able to get those safe harbor notifications? I'm sure that we all know that if you go up onto YouTube and if you put the name of a song into it, you're likely to come up with a series of, you know, results after your search query that show maybe mashups or videos that also include the song. So you can basically listen to songs over YouTube. And those are not always posted by the actual content owners. They're not always posted with authorization from the content owners onto YouTube. And the content holders have been sort of upset about this because they want to have control over their copyrighted works. So what was UMG's biggest problem then with the safe harbor and the way that VO has been using it? And there's actually not one problem. There's several problems, or at least in the eyes of UMG.
You're going to have to be a little more specific there.
So UMG had a series of contentions about why Section 512 should not apply to VO.
I think one of them was that, let's say I'm a rebellious user, wow, Freudian slip, and I keep uploading music videos, and the site keeps taking them down, and I keep uploading them using the same username. I think UMG argued that, well, you should have banned those users and made them never come back because they were no good and you knew it.
That was certainly one. I think maybe we'll start off with the bigger one, which is that UMG had this opinion that because VO is one of these user-generated content services where the users are consistently using the service to upload infringing content, that just by way of the nature of how people use the site, that alone is enough to establish some measure of imputed knowledge that there are infringing activities going on the site. And part of the Section 512 notice requirements require that the content owners specify the materials that are uploaded onto the site that are infringing. And what the RIAA was doing, and the RIAA was sort of acting as an intermediary between the, because it's the representative trade organization between the some of the content holders. The RIAA was sending notices to UMG, and they were identifying particular songs and particular artists, but they weren't pointing to which ones were actually infringing. And the argument that UMG then was using was that, well, because we've sort of sent these blanket notices that this song is being infringed on the website, that UMG then has some sort of affirmative obligation then based on the notice that was sent, to go ahead and act on the notice and take down those infringing materials.
Right, and that kind of goes counter to what we understand of the DMCA, in that you have to be more specific, with the exception of that ALS scan case, where I think literally everything, I mean, everything in that that news group was infringing. I'm pretty sure that, like I said, everything there was infringing. Meanwhile, in this case, people could be uploading their own music videos. People could be uploading music videos, or, you know, something with the name of a music video that doesn't actually contain the music video itself, some sort of commentary on it. There are a lot of exceptions that you could envision where the use would either be fair use or actually non-infringing.
Right. So, I mean, fair use is obviously one of the biggest limitations on the Copyright Act itself. It serves as a limitation to the exclusive rights that the a copyright holder has. And it operates under the law, for the most part, as a defense to infringement. But it's sort of, again, a little bit gray, but not as much. It's not necessarily an affirmative right that people have to use other people's content. But at the same time, fair use is still there. So, like you said, Ben, it's totally possible that somebody could use somebody's copyrighted work and create something that maybe for the purposes of critical commentary or something includes either a portion or maybe even in whole that copyrighted work, and it would constitute or it could constitute fair use under the Copyright Act and therefore would not be infringing. So that is sort of one of the problems here, is that you have these content holder companies are submitting these notices of infringement to VO, and then VO then under the Act would be required to take them down. But the gray area is that it's a little bit unclear if under what circumstances VO should have to be required to take them down, and you have to go on the notice that they're sent. So part of the notice also requires under the notice, I think you have a legal requirement to state that you believe in good faith that your work is being infringed on as the content has been uploaded. And so you have to go on that notice that says that UMG believes that their content is being infringed, which sort of seems to say that UMG has to have a good faith belief that whatever the work is not fair use. So what did the court think of this argument, and how did that pan out?
The court did not take kindly to any of UMG's argument in this case. Although I will say, you mentioned, I just want to go back to this for a second. You mentioned that you have to have a good faith belief that it's infringing. Fair use is a defense to infringement,
right,
so it could
right.
still be infringing, but be excused under fair use. And technically, at least last I checked, fair use is not a proper reason to counter notice for the DMCA, which is something that we'll touch on a little later in the podcast, a little later in this story. But, this is obviously arguable. The McCain campaign even commented on this during the last election. But it seems like under the way that the DMCA is currently written, you could take down, a copyright owner could take down something that falls under fair use, and the person who uploaded that content would have no legal remedy under the DMCA. But this is a conversation for another day.
Mm-hmm. So getting back to the question then, on these blanket notices, what did the court think about the argument that sending a blanket notice that says this artist and these songs are being infringed on the website, and therefore you should have to, the burden then shifts to VO, and they have to go and take them all down.
The court basically said that that's antithetical to the entire purpose behind the DMCA. And we can't put on the people who make these. The DMCA says that we can't make the owners of the websites have this positive duty to go out and find every infringing thing on their website as soon as they find out that there's one infringing thing on the website, even if there are multiple similar copies. That's just not the way the DMCA is built. It says that, quoting from the opinion, VO presented undisputed evidence that simply searching for a name would not necessarily unearth only unauthorized material. There are lots of reasons why you would name, something Black Eyed Peas. It could be an instructional video as to how to make black-eyed peas, for instance, or harvest them. I've never had black-eyed peas. Anyway, did that get to the heart of your question, David?
Yeah, I think it did, that the court basically didn't approve of this argument that because your website is known and because all the employees at VO are aware of the fact that the site is consistently used for purposes of uploading infringing works, that alone is not enough to sort of impute the actual knowledge that's required under the Act to force VO to take down the uploaded videos.
Right.
What do you guys think about some of the other contentious points that UMG had in the case, and are you familiar with them, first of all?
Yes. So one of my favorite arguments that UMG made is that VO, quote, avoided gaining knowledge of infringement by delaying implementation of what's called Audible Magic. It's the music fingerprinting system that I was talking about earlier. So they say that the system was available in 2005 and they didn't implement it till October 2007. And the hashing technology that I talked about, where they compare previously uploaded and taken down songs and videos to ones that have been uploaded more recently, that was implemented in 2006. The court basically said that argument is absurd for two reasons. One, VO had no obligation to install that software anyway, so saying that they had actual knowledge because they delayed doing that is absurd. Secondly, it showed good faith on the part of VO, because, like I said, they didn't have any obligation to do this. They could have never installed that and just made, you know, UMG and the RIAA search their website for infringing content all the time. In this case, you know, it was VO, you know, taking a step to make it easier for these content providers to, you know, keep them from having to search for all of this stuff. I don't really know where UMG thought they were going to get with that argument.
Well, is there something under the Section 512 that requires some sort of affirmative policy on the part of the service provider to have a policy in place to expeditiously take care of these matters?
Say that one more time. To have the policy in place to expeditiously take care of, is there an obligation?
Yeah, does the DMCA basically require the VO in this case to have these mechanisms in place to take down the content or to sort of automate the process?
I don't think it does. Why would it?
I mean, so there are certain things that you have to have on your website, somebody to contact about these DMC takedown notices. You do have to take them down quickly, but there's nothing that I know of in the DMCA that says you have to have a filtering technology. That's... David? Am I missing
right.
something here?
No, you're absolutely right. So I think where they were reading into is the that they were trying to find an argument through the statute itself that there should be some sort of obligation for VO to have these technologies implemented to take care of it all. And they had a number of control technologies, including, as you mentioned, the hash filtering. They also had their terms of service agreement, which wholeheartedly prohibits uploading infringing videos. They also had some sort of audio fingerprinting technology, which would compare works as they were uploaded to the content, to like a repository of the content owner's works. And let's see here. Oh, and then they would have an internal policy of terminating users who are repeat infringers.
This case is a doozy. We could spend an entire podcast just talking about under the DMCA.
So one of the arguments that UMG threw out there was that, as you mentioned, with the Audible technology that they used, they wanted to impose some sort of liability on VO for having not implemented it earlier, number one, but they also sort of had this argument that if there's a superior filtering technology available out there, that VO has to use it.
Yeah, those
Do you guys
arguments.
Know what the court said about that?
They didn't really fly either, although I'm having trouble finding the exact language right now.
If I'm not mistaken, that falls under the same thing as they don't have any duty to have these filtering technologies in place anyway, so why would they have to have the best ones?
If there was a superior technology out there, I mean, would it help prevent then? It would obviously help prevent these things from the infringing videos from being uploaded more frequently. But is there any sort of obligation that a website or a company like Veo, who knows that people are using the site to upload infringing videos, could you read into any way that if they knew that there was a better way out there to do this, that they would have to implement it? If they're not using their best practices, and this sort of goes back to the language that talks about the expeditious removal upon notice, too.
Right, but that's expeditious removal upon notice, and here the technology would be providing them with notice, correct?
It would, and one of the things that UMG and some of the other content holders had done is they had... I don't think the opinion actually talks about this specifically, but you get little hints at what was sort of going on between UMG and Veo. And it looks like Veo had either a repository of some of the copyrighted works that UMG had given them, and so that allowed some of the software technology they had to compare videos as they were uploaded to this repository. It's sort of like an index repository, and if they matched close enough, they could automatically take them down. And so by way of that, you could argue, even though that there wasn't any infringement incurring before they already had the repository, that UMG is putting them on notice that these songs are being infringed a lot, and you need to look out. And we have not, and they're also basically saying that we have not authorized their uploading to the website. So by way of that, and that's using the technology that you have, that might be enough to satisfy some sort of notice.
But the court rejected that argument?
They sure did.
I can certainly see why, in that it just... I mean, there's a difference between receiving notice and affirmatively going out and getting notice yourself or installing technology to give you notice. While it might not necessarily be the ideal situation for copyright holders, it's certainly... The reverse, I guess, would be far more burdensome on websites. And I think that the court wants to continue to provide or continue to make it possible for websites to serve as sort of distribution points for all sorts of creative information out there that make it interesting and useful to use the internet. And they don't want to really have a chilling effect on websites and what they host if they had to all install notice requirements or all install expensive software that would act to give them notice. That could, I mean, shut down a lot of small sites, could dissuade people from starting new sites. So I understand the court's reasoning.
So I think that sums up pretty much some of the main points in this case, but it was a pretty big win for Veo, and I think that we got some pretty good clarification on what Section 512 is and... you know, how it should be applied to user-generated content websites where you have people that are uploading a lot of infringing content, and it provided good clarification that Section 512 does indeed apply. So, for the sake of brevity, I think, if we're not already deep into this enough, we should move on to the next case, which involves the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And this was a decision that came down this week, and actually it was an appeal that went through the Ninth Circuit that stemmed out of a case in Nevada. So the case title is LVRC Holdings versus Breca, and it stems out of these interesting facts where you had this guy, Chris Breca, and his wife, who were running a consulting company, and they had two consulting companies. One was registered in Nevada and one was registered in Florida. They were both registered under the same name. They were engaged in a consulting relationship with this company, LVRC Holdings, which owned and operated a facility, a residential treatment facility for addicted persons. And at some time during the course of the relationship, Breca had been, he was working on, I think, some internet marketing promotions and working a lot with the LVRC web servers, which happened to be run by this other third company called Load Incorporated. Sometime during the course of the consulting relationship, though, Brekka had been assigned a work computer in Nevada, and he had been busy traveling back and forth between Nevada and Florida with both of these consulting businesses that he had, and didn't have access to the machine that was located at the facilities. So what he was doing was emailing himself a lot of the documents that he was working on. In addition to that, during the consulting relationship, Brekka had also engaged in some discussions about possibly purchasing some sort of ownership interest in the facility itself. And during the course of that negotiations, which eventually fell flat, he had also emailed himself some of the confidential documents. And separately, the other interesting thing about this case is that, and this is how the company Load comes into it, is that while he was working on these promotional campaigns for the treatment facility, Load, who was running all of the web servers, gave him basically an administrative password, which allowed him to log into the servers and access various statistical information and other types of confidential or potentially confidential information about the residential treatment center. So what also popped up during this is that Brekka, at the same time, also owned two other businesses that were basically involved in an online referral service for residential treatment centers. And what happened basically was Brekka, at some point, the relationship ended. He was no longer consulting, but he had retained all of those documents that he had emailed himself on his laptop, and I think on his desktop machines too that he might have had, but on other machines besides the ones that were located within the LVRC facility. And at another point in time, he had logged back in after the employment relationship was over to the LVRC web servers using that administrative login. And the LVRC Holdings Company decided to sue Brekka for violating the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act for exceeding authorized access on the computer systems. And they had two separate theories, obviously, one for the emails themselves and a separate one for logging in into the machines after the relationship had terminated. Why don't we start off by explaining the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act?
I mean, we can do the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act briefly. We talked about this a lot in the context of the Lori Drew case. So the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act has two parts. It's got a criminal part and a civil part. So with Lori Drew, we saw the criminal side, where an assistant U.S. attorney was prosecuting Lori Drew for gaining unauthorized access to the MySpace computers in the Central District of Northern District or Central District of California? Central District. It has a civil side too, which is what we're seeing in this case, where the company LVRC Holdings is suing their former employee consultant Brekka for exceeding his authorized access to the computer and taking files from it.
So one of the key portions of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act is this concept of exceeding authorized access on a computer. What do we know about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act as it stands today, and how that might be used, and what was so different about how it was trying to be applied in this case?
Well, I guess the biggest distinction here is that the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act sort of lays down a standard for authorized access, or it doesn't lay down a standard so much. It presumes there's some notion of authorized access. And here, this case, the company didn't really have an authorized access structure. They just were arguing that, oh, this access was unauthorized, even though there was no statement or no agreement or no legal delineation of what made authorized access.
Right, that's a great point, too, because in this case, actually, and I don't know if there was a policy in place at LVRC Holdings in particular, but there was definitely no policy between Brekka and LVRC in terms of the consulting relationship. There was nothing that spoke to the point about what his authorized access would be under the on the computer systems at the facility.
Right, and this draws an interesting parallel to the Lori Drew case, where in that case, one of the
reasons the judge ruled the way he did in overturning her conviction was because Lori Drew, there was nothing in the terms of service, in the terms of service with MySpace, that said at what point, if you violate the terms of service like she did by providing a fake name, at what point does that turn into unauthorized access to the site? It didn't have anything in the terms of service that really explained that. So similarly here, there wasn't anything in his working relationship with the company that said if you do a certain thing, you will exceed your access or you'll no longer be authorized to access the computer systems.
So sort of the meat of at least one of their claims was that because Brekka was engaged with these other companies that he owned, the referral companies in particular, that when he was emailing himself the documents, although he was authorized to use the computers then, what he was doing was really adverse to the company's interests. And that alone should form some sort of basis of liability under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. What did the court think about that?
The court did not look kindly upon that argument. They said that a mere breach of fiduciary duty will not constitute... fiduciary duty is it's a duty that's owed to usually a company
fiduciary.
Or a free person. Yeah, it's your duty owed by a fiduciary. A fiduciary is somebody who has a monetary stake in a company who... I wish there was an easy way of describing it.
Well, it's a... in broad, I think you can describe it as a obligation to act in the best interests of another person or another entity.
Right. I'll agree with that.
I mean, that's a loose definition, but for our purposes, that probably satisfies it. So, interestingly, and you keep mentioning the Lori Drew case, which involved the MySpace Terms of Use Agreement, which we talked about, I think, 2 weeks ago now, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act is often used in civil litigation to, and terms of use agreements are often used in litigation under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act to establish that somebody has exceeded authorized access. Factually distinguishable in this case, though, is that there was no such agreement in place, and the court was sort of hammering away that if you don't have some sort of either a confidentiality agreement, a non-disclosure agreement maybe, or some other sort of employee policy about using computers, it's simply not enough to establish a violation that somebody has exceeded their authorized access under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. So the other interesting thing here, one of the takeaways is that you have two parts to the unauthorized access. You have the having the emails while he was an employee, and then also having them when he was no longer an employee, and the court seemed to be of the opinion that distinction didn't really matter at all.
Right. So we've already dispensed with the first one. Taking an email, you know, downloading it to your personal computer when it's not in the best interest of the company, we've already established that's not a violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. If you were authorized to download it, you're authorized to download it. Your intent does not matter.
So what about after you're no longer an employee?
In that case, essentially the argument is that there is no access after that. Yes, it was still on the computer, on his personal computer, but there wasn't an additional unauthorized access or an excess of authorized access.
So in other words, the court basically threw that out of the case.
Yes.
And did you guys catch the portion of the case that talked about Brekka logging into the sysadmin control panel?
Yeah, that was kind of weird in that it was his password and it was kind of where he was, but there wasn't a lot of evidence that it was him who did it, other than that it was his username. If I'm reading that, it's
right. I think it was about a year after he had been terminated as an employee. One of the administrators from Load noticed that someone had logged in under his username into the control panel, and that the IP address that was associated with that user ID was located in Redwood City, California. And interestingly, Mr. Breca was apparently in California at the same time, in Northern California at the same time, for a conference. And what did the court think of that argument that there's some sort of inference that you can make that Breca was the person that was logging into the servers after he had been terminated, just because he was in the same area at the same time and it was his user ID?
Well, I mean, it points to that it might be him. Doesn't necessarily guarantee that it is, but it points to it.
Yeah, the court actually decided that the factual basis for that inference there apparently wasn't enough, and they decided that it wasn't enough to proceed forward based on the claim without any further evidence that you could establish that it was indeed him that was logging in. Part of the problem is that the IP address that they had could only be traced back to the ISP. It wasn't actually being traced back to the actual machine. So it created these evidentiary problems, and both LVRC and Breca had expert testimony, I think in the form of affidavits that were submitted for the purposes of the motion, that LVRC suggested that you could, in fact, trace it back to Breca, and of course Breca had contended that no, you can't really, the traceable path stops at the ISP, and therefore it's just simply not enough to have a claim that suggests that he was the one that was logging in. Do you guys have any other thoughts on this?
No, other than that this is at least to some extent a boon for employees. It limits to some—I don't know. It limits to some degree the likelihood of you being prosecuted by your former company for, you know, exceeding authorized access or unauthorized access to your computer systems. That being said, it gives them a lot more guidance as to how, you know, if they want to pursue you, you know, how they should craft their user policies. That being said, I don't think that this is a big issue that people are going to have to worry about. You got to do something pretty awful to your company to make them want to prosecute you after you leave, especially under something like the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, when there are remedies under contract law for a lot of these things. Essentially, at least my view is, if companies start suing employees after they leave for things like this, unless the employees have, you know, really screwed the company over, the company is not really going to be able to get new employees if they have a history of suing people.
Well, one thing the court didn't really speak a whole lot about is what types of agreements are acceptable to establish user access guidelines, and at what point do you actually exceed your authorized access on a particular computer system. And I think that the case actually leaves open a lot, although it seems like it's a really positive case for shedding light on the limitations of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. It leaves open the door that if you simply have a general employee policy maybe, or some other type of agreement that is set before all new employees or all existing employees at a company, that you're not to do anything that is adverse to the interests of the company while you're using our computers, that seems to set up a liability scheme then under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
Right, and this is the kind of thing that we're just going to have to keep an eye on as the case law develops, and as I'm sure people, if companies change their policies based on this case, people will post them online to the extent that they can without, you know, violating company policy about use of their computers.
Okay, well, I think that probably pretty much sums up this case for the week, and it also we come to the end of our podcast. So, thanks for tuning in and listening. Again, we're gonna post these two other stories, and I'm gonna mention them quickly here. Google came out with and published their full response to the FCC inquiry involving Google and Apple and AT&T and the denial of the Google Voice app. So we will have a post available on the website in the next few days, or hopefully by the time this podcast is released. And there's another interesting case that came out in California called Calvin Chang v- versus the University Regions of California. University Regions of California, involving the unmasking of an anonymous commenter on a website. And it doesn't necessarily do anything new to the law, but it sets forth yet another standard that we have to look at when we're talking about anonymity issues and revealing people that are posting things online. So thanks for tuning in again, and I was your host this week. My name is David O'Brien, and with me today I've got
Dominic Rabier
and Ben Snitkoff.
Thanks for tuning in, and be sure to check us out on www.technicallylegal.org.